The Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy together, please. And we're going to hear Senate Bill 598 first. There has been a request to hear that early by Senator Dingfelder. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 598. Could you give us a rundown on that, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 598 requires drug manufacturers to establish a pharmaceutical take-back program approved and regulated by the Department of Human Services. It also creates an advisory committee on pharmaceutical take-back programs and establishes and continually appropriates money to a pharmaceutical take-back program fund for departmental regulation of the programs. And my understanding is we have a dash one amendment that you'll be getting a handout of momentarily.
Okay. Senator Dingfelder, would you come up, please?
Good morning, committee members. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I'm Jackie Dingfelder. I'm state senator for District 23. And again, I appreciate you also moving it up, since I do have judiciary at 8:30 and we'll have to sneak out to my committee hearing. So you have before you the Oregon Drug Take-Back Bill. This is an important bill that can help in reducing prescription drug misuse. It could also assist in protecting Oregon's water quality. In short, Senate Bill 598 requires drug manufacturers that serve Oregon to institute a safe and convenient system for unwanted and unused drugs to be returned in an environmentally safe manner for disposal. This issue has been studied extensively by a broad stakeholder group. Many of the folks are here today that you'll hear from. This includes public health advocates, local governments, drinking water utilities, state agencies, pharmacists, environmental public interest groups, and drug manufacturers. The bill before you is the interest of that broad stakeholder engagement. So the main impetus for this bill is public health protection. Initially, I was interested in a drug take-back program as a tool to tackle water quality issues. But the more I learned about this subject, the more convinced I am that it is most importantly an issue related to public health. The strongest motivator for instituting a convenient and safe system for disposing of unwanted drugs is to protect Oregonians from avoidable poisonings and to prevent prescription drug abuse, especially among teens. As you will see in my written testimony, and hopefully you have a packet, data from the Oregon Public Health Division underscores this urgency. The rate of hospitalization for Oregon children from unintentional poisoning increased 60%. Much of this increase can be attributed to prescription medications. For Oregonians 15 to 54 years of age, self-inflicted poisoning is the leading cause of injury hospitalization. Surprisingly, and I was surprised to learn this, this surpasses the hospitalization rate for car accidents. Law enforcement agencies in communities such as Winston and Deschutes County are putting systems in place to collect unwanted drugs as an intervention tool to prevent drug abuse. We need to follow that lead and design a convenient system statewide for all Oregonians to safely dispose of their unwanted medicines. This bill also follows the product stewardship model that is similar to a bill that passed last session, the computer recycling bill, which passed unanimously in both the House and Senate. This product stewardship model addresses the issue of unwanted and unused drugs. Essentially, we're asking that the drug manufacturers put a safe and convenient system in place to properly dispose of unwanted medicines at their expense, no expense to the state or consumers. This is the same system that British Columbia has used for collecting unwanted drugs since 1996, and I will call attention to a handout in your packet that is double-sided, explains the British Columbia system, and in the back you will see a list of almost every pharmaceutical company that probably is very similar to the list of pharmaceutical companies in this country that are participating. This program that serves British Columbia collecting about 52,000 pounds of unwanted drugs at a total cost of $280,000. Here in the U.S., Washington, Florida, Maine, and Minnesota are all considering the drug take-back legislation this year. Each state is proposing to use a product stewardship model, and in fact, the language in several of those bills is similar to the language in this bill. I am convinced that a product stewardship system is the best path for us to take when addressing the complex problems related to proper return and disposal of unwanted consumer products. It's a system that uses the power of the market and the business smarts of these manufacturers to make the program work. I do believe Oregonians want action, and that's why I brought the bill to this committee for consideration. In my written testimony, you will see the results of a Department of Environmental Quality survey of Oregonians' behaviors and perceptions about environmental and health risks. The one indicator from the survey I'll mention here is that 90% of respondents were willing to return their unwanted pharmaceuticals to a pharmacy, and 85% were willing to return them by mail. Oregonians recognize the need for a better way to dispose of unwanted medicines, and they're ready to participate in a drug take-back program. However, you'll hear that there are many reasons why a drug take-back program is not needed. First, you're going to hear that it doesn't decrease the amount of pharmaceuticals in our water, or that people can just throw unwanted drugs out with their household trash, or that education is the best way to decrease a patient's noncompliance with a drug regime, which will result in fewer unwanted drugs in a person's home. First and foremost, a drug take-back program is an important way to address misuse of prescription drugs. According to the annual survey conducted by the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University, teens say it is now easier for them to acquire prescription drugs than alcohol, and most teens get their prescription drugs straight from the medicine cabinet. Besides teens, older Oregonians also have important health concerns when it comes to prescription drugs. People over age 65 take an average of 11 different prescription drugs per year. The National Institute on Drug Abuse reports that older patients often self-diagnose and misunderstand the label warnings, which can result in overdosing, underdosing, or taking a prescription drug for a non-prescribed reason, or taking an expired medication. A drug take-back program will rid homes of unwanted and unused drugs and reduce the availability of prescription drugs for misuse and abuse. Second, while it is true that people can throw unwanted medications out with their household trash, this is not illegal now, here are the steps a person needs to go through. It's recommended by the American Pharmacists Association. First, remove and destroy all personal identifying information on the medication container. Second, crush medications or add water to dissolve them. Third, mix with kitty litter or coffee grounds. Fourth, place in a sealed plastic bag. And then fifth, put it in the trash. A drug take-back program would be much simpler and much less time-consuming than this disposal method, and much safer. Third, an education program should be part of any proper disposal program, but it shouldn't be the only part. I met with Pharma, and they have an education program called Smart Disposal, which instructs medication users to follow the prescriber's instructions and use all medications as instructed. If there are any unused medications at the end, a person can follow the steps listed before or check for approved state and local collection alternatives, such as community-based household hazardous waste collection programs, and take them there, which, of course, you probably know are not found consistently throughout the state. If a disposal method is too difficult, a consumer is simply not going to use it. A drug take-back program would be easier and much more convenient for consumers to use. Finally, you will hear from Pharma about the challenges in working with the Drug Enforcement Agency. They are in the process, DEA is in the process of developing rules right now to address this issue because so many states are interested in moving forward with a program such as this, and I'm sure you know that this is under the purview of the federal DEA. My own experience talking with Oregonians is that they are concerned about issues surrounding unwanted and unused drugs. They want a better method of disposal than flushing them down the toilet, which is what they've been told for years, or putting them out in the household trash where they'll end up in the landfill or possibly be picked out by other folks, which we certainly don't want. A drug take-back program is a safe, convenient, and environmentally sound alternative, and I hope Oregon will follow this model. So I appreciate your time this morning. I look forward to working with you on this important bill. You're going to hear from a lot of experts this morning who have been working on this issue for about a year and a half. I do just want to call attention to the Dash 1 amendments, which was put in at my request, and that's to fix there was some wording missing about the funding. And this fiscal bill, or the fiscal in this bill, if this amendment is adopted, should be zero because the cost is paid by the manufacturer, so it'll be zero to the state. So I just wanted to clarify that. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions, but I want to make sure that you get to hear from the experts here today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Monizan.
Can you remind me, did we pass any legislation regarding electronics?
Yes, that was last session. That
and
was the
how was the payment for that?
That's exactly the same. The manufacturers pay. We have two positions at DEQ that administer the program. There is no cost to the consumer, and we banned electronics from the landfill as part of that bill.
And so, okay. So
in essence, it is supposed to be built into the cost of the product. We did not require that. We said the manufacturer has to pay a fee, and they pay a fee to the state, and that's how that program is funded.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Dingfelder. I could get into some of the issues about unintentional poisoning, and I would suggest some hard numbers would be good there, not the 60%, but how many, and I would also suggest that a lot of those are, although they may be drug-related, are not drugs people are taking out of garbage cans, but drugs they are buying on the street, because that is a significant problem. But I guess my biggest concern is with the Dash 1 Amendment, it appears that what you're doing is allowing the agency to impose a fee without any legislative oversight or legislative approval of the fee, that they can just do it. I've seen that taking place several times this session, that we are no longer requiring an agency to come back to the legislature for approval of a fee increase, and that's the way I'm reading this. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chair and Senator, first of all, I didn't go into the specifics because you're going to hear on some of the statistics. You're going to hear from the experts today, and I certainly don't profess to be an expert on health issues. Regarding the fee, that's the way this is read, but certainly you're the experts, you're the committee, and you could take that and make changes to the amendment, but that's what we proposed.
Yeah.
That's the way it was done with the e-waste bill.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, this is a precedent we're setting here that I find incredibly troubling. That we authorize an agency to collect a fee for whatever, and then we wash our hands of it, and they can do with the fee whatever they want and increase it or decrease it at their whim.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I have no objection if you would like to set the fee.
Senator Monizan.
I think we might need clarification because I thought any fee is actually taken before Ways and Means. It's all those that the agencies, let's see. There is one bill that has all the fees that the agencies are responsible for, and they do come before the Ways and Means.
And with the e-waste bill, it did go to the Ways and Means. What we did is created because it wasn't in the governor's budget, it had to. And same with this. It's not in the governor's budget. This would be a proposal, obviously, that if this body decided and wanted to adopt, it would go through the Ways and Means process. What we had to do is get approval for those positions that were paid through the other funds. They were not general fund positions.
Just follow up. No, I just wanted to clarify that if an agency has responsibility for a fee, those fees still have to come before Ways and Means. They just don't come individually. They come before them.
And I serve on the Ways and Means Subcommittee, so that's what we do with the natural resource fees as well.
Mr. Chair, one more. Senator Dingfelder, now you said the DEA is looking at a national program. I mean, what sense do you have as to where they're moving on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, they're actually looking at rulemaking. They would not be doing the program themselves, but because so many states are looking at this type of program, I'm sure you know that the DEA controls any movement of controlled substances, and it was really interesting for me to learn that obviously you get your drugs now. I have a mail back pharmacy that I work with, or a mail out pharmacy, and get some of my prescriptions through the mail. And so that's not a problem, but if you're mailing them back or you're taking it back to the pharmacy, that's where the controlled substance come in. And there is law enforcement here, so you'll hear more directly from them. Again, I'm not an expert on the law enforcement elements of this, but it is regulated at the national level. So in order for a state program to work, we either need a waiver or new rules. And the DEA is working on new rules because so many states are looking at this. And I don't know as far as the timing, and you'll probably hear more about that from some of the other witnesses.
Thank you.
Palmer Mason?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to working with the committee on it. Thank you for the excellent questions.
Thank you.
Is there someone from Public Health here that wants to testify? Yes. Would you come up to also, please, Public Health? Palmer, would you go ahead and introduce yourself and get started?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I work for the Division of Land Quality. I'm here to testify in support of drug take-back legislation. Drugs get into the environment in two ways: excretion from our bodies and direct disposal into sewage systems or landfills. Currently, unwanted medicines get thrown into the garbage or flushed down the toilet. We know some of this unwanted medicine passes through septic systems, landfills, and wastewater treatment plants. No one knows exactly how much of these medicines in our environment come from these two pathways. However, we do know that a significant amount goes unused. A 2008 DEQ survey of Oregon households found that a majority of the respondents who purchased medicines reported having leftovers needing disposal. The leftover medicines were most commonly flushed down the toilet or put into the garbage, 43% and 42% respectively. DEQ is developing a comprehensive toxic reduction strategy focused on chemicals of highest concern for human health and the environment. Our strategy will emphasize reducing toxic chemicals at the source, which is a much more cost-effective way than controlling or cleaning up the chemicals once they enter the environment. Drug take-back legislation is consistent with that approach. Take-back legislation provides consumers with a safe and convenient alternative for managing unwanted medicines. More important, it reduces the risk that chemicals will be released into our environment compared to dumping unwanted medicines into septic tanks, sewage systems, or landfills. As a part of DEQ's toxic reduction strategy, and to implement 2007 legislation passed by this legislature, DEQ has published an initial list of persistent priority pollutants. That draft list contains multiple pharmaceuticals. When this list of priority pollutants is final, it will help DEQ and others focus their efforts and take actions to reduce the release of toxic chemicals. Numerous studies document the presence of drugs in the environment, including surface water, groundwater, sediments, and treated drinking water. The studies predominantly conclude that drugs are present whenever wastewater has been discharged. Conventional wastewater treatment systems do not effectively remove or destroy drugs. No single treatment process can completely remove the thousands of different pharmaceutical compounds. And I have some studies here to demonstrate what we're talking about. A recent study of the Lower Columbia Basin conducted by the U.S. Geological Survey detected 15 of 20 pharmaceutical compounds, with the largest number of compounds found in the Tualatin River and Fano Creek. Monitoring by DEQ and the U.S. Geological Survey of drinking source water has detected pharmaceutical compounds at multiple locations just upstream from intake points. Recent studies have researched the effect of pharmaceuticals on aquatic life. And even though more study is needed to make definitive conclusions about such effects, much of this research suggests that low levels of pharmaceuticals in the water can adversely impact the endocrine systems of aquatic species, as well as impede their growth, development, and predator response. It is DEQ's policy to implement product stewardship solutions for hard-to-manage and toxic waste products. In fact, DEQ's Environmental Quality Commission has formally endorsed using a manufacturer-provided drug take-back approach to reducing unwanted chemicals in the environment. DEQ and the EQC support using a drug take-back approach because it provides consumers with a convenient and safe alternative to throwing away or flushing away unwanted medicines and helps to eliminate unwanted medicines as a source of harmful chemicals in the environment. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Public Health Division of Oregon's Department of Human Services. And with me today is my colleague and peer, Dr. Katrina Hedberg, who is the state epidemiologist and also is the administrator of the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology in that same division, in that same department. We are here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 598, designed to reduce exposure to and accessibility of unused medications. We are focused for three reasons on this bill. One is poisonings, particularly among children, prescription drug abuse and addiction, and water contamination from medications, as Palmer was just referencing. As you may recall, my office oversees the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act on behalf of 3,600 drinking water systems throughout this state, most of them very small, serving fewer than 500 people apiece. And frankly, we simply cannot engineer our way to clean and safe drinking water. These systems were never designed to and simply cannot deal with the kinds of very pharmaceutical-grade drugs that as Palmer mentioned, we are finding in the water. But first, I just want to make one comment about drug-associated poisonings in Oregon. They have increased in recent years and really have become a public health problem. During the past 5 years, over 1,100 Oregonians have died due to unintentional poisonings from drugs. Children 0 to 14 years, the hospitalization rate due to unintentional poisoning is almost twice the rate for the population overall, and 75% of those hospitalizations involve prescription drugs and other medicines commonly found in the home. Reducing the number of medications, therefore, in the homes, we see as a potential to help address this very real problem. Prescription drug abuse, I mentioned also, data suggests that 1 in 4 Oregon adults will abuse prescription drugs in his or her lifetime. Nationally, more persons initiated non-medical use of narcotic pain relievers in the past year than those who initiated use of marijuana or cocaine. Again, reducing the accessibility of medications around the home may help deal with this issue by reducing prescription drug availability.
Gail, the abuse of prescription drugs that are left over may occur by other family members, but there is another abuse of prescription drugs, and that's doctor shopping. That is a much broader problem than I think the leftover pills in the home. Just a thought.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Contamination of drinking water, as I mentioned, is a third seemingly disconnected but actually quite connected concern. As Palmer mentioned, DEQ and the United States Geological Survey have both been doing some monitoring and testing in Oregon surface waters. And nationally, USGS has found that pharmaceuticals are detected in both groundwater and surface water sources used for drinking water. A recent AP story, Associated Press story, detailed the detections of pharmaceuticals in U.S. drinking water systems, including Portland. Although the dose...
Okay. Where does that come from, do you think?
Mr. Chair, where do pharmaceuticals come from?
In the water, yeah.
From us.
From us.
One way or the other.
One way or the other.
Exactly.
Not necessarily flushing them down the toilet, though.
Mr. Chair, I would be shocked if that were the sole pathway.
Okay. So there is...
But we simply don't know. But
well, I mean, they pass through our body, right?
Mr. Chair, excretion is absolutely a part of the normal biological process.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, I don't know that the problems that we're facing are necessarily from drugs that are flushed down the toilet before you take the drugs and put them in the water. I mean, I think that there's going to be more and more traces of pharmaceuticals in the water simply because more and more people are using them. So I'm not sure how much of a problem this will solve, is what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, I believe you put your finger precisely on the debate. Yeah. How much of the problem, is this an issue? Is this a problem? And if it is, then how much, if any, does this kind of effort deal with? And I personally, professionally speaking, I don't know that that's a knowable, I don't think that there's a knowable response to that. I work with my colleagues around the nation on safe drinking water issues. I serve on Association of State and Territorial Health Officials Safe Water Working Group. We grapple with this. We've provided comments to the United States Environmental Protection Agency. We've responded to proposed rules. I'm very engaged on this issue from a drinking water perspective. And frankly, we simply don't know. What we are convinced of, again, based on our professional experience and discussion and review of the literature and studies and so on, is that trying to treat the water from the intake to the tap in a way that deals with the concern about the presence of pharmaceuticals, about the additive, synergistic, and cumulative effects of those chemicals. I think the world of engineers, but we simply cannot engineer our way to that level of confidence and safety and cleanliness. So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Miles Sanders.
Yeah. I still say if we can get to the moon, we can figure out this problem. But
to the moon 40 years.
But what I would like to know, and I know many of this room have probably had their parent die, and I had literally a bag full of medication that the foster care home that my mother was in gave back to me. And I hate to say it, but I still haven't disposed of it. And then my father the same way. So I would like to know at right now how hospitals dispose of their medications and how nursing homes, when someone passes on, how do they dispose of their medication and assisted living? Because when my father was in assisted living, I did not get that, get his medication back. And who knows whose hands they ended up in. So I would like to have that information at some point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miles Sanderson, I believe you may have at least some of that answer as a result of the testimony today. I understand that there are folks here who are going to testify from at least some of those types of facilities that you reference.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, members, as you can see, several divisions within DHS, several offices and efforts and programs in DHS are focused on the different aspects or dimensions of this issue. Addictions and Mental Health Division, a sister division to the Public Health Division, recognizes that misuse, abuse, and diversion of prescription drugs are a threat to public health and safety. The Injury Prevention Program and Dr. Hedberg's office analyzes data on poisoning, hospitalizations, and deaths in our state. And as I mentioned, our drinking water program assists local communities help provide safe, reliably safe, and clean drinking water. So we do support the pharmaceutical take-back program because it may help address these different aspects of this public health problem. We do need to note, and as my written testimony makes very clear, the fee authority and the position authority in the bill are not contained in the governor's recommended budget, as Senator Dingfelder also identified. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I do want to draw your attention to the other handouts that I provided. One is from Dr. Hedberg's office, the Unintentional Drug Poisoning in Oregon fact sheet. Second is from a Portland, Oregon newspaper from last June. Hard to swallow, do tiny quantities of drugs in drinking water pose a threat to human health? Question mark. Frustratingly enough, they didn't answer that question. Also from a scientific journal, Environmental Science and Technology, pharmaceuticals and endocrine-disrupting compounds in U.S. drinking water, and lastly, just out literally a couple days ago from the Journal of the AMA, traces of drugs found in drinking water, health effects unknown, safer disposal urged. So I commend those articles for your reference and information. Happy to take any questions you may have.
Senator Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that there are several things that I need to kind of lift up on your radar. First is that we're in an economic crisis, and the Ways and Means co-chairs have made it very clear that there will be absolutely no new programs. This would be a new program, obviously, so I want to raise that issue. We have been designing an expansion of the bottle bill, and the pushback comes because it has to be extremely convenient. In other words, even if it's a distribution center, where is it going to be located? So you're faced with something that has to be extremely convenient in setting up such a program. If I don't want to have to take my bottle and look at it and see which manufacturer, and then I have to take it to one place, and then if it's a different manufacturer, take it over here. The other thing that bothers me is the bureaucratic setup. There's an advisory board, there's a fee that's charged, there's the same old, same song, 10th verse for state government. So I always get a little bored with that. And then there's another subsection here that all agencies of government are directed to assist this advisory committee in the performance of their duties. Does that mean that if you know of someone that's not returning their drugs, you can now spy on them and say that they are not returning their drugs, therefore they can be charged this $250? In theory, let me finish by saying obviously we don't want to drink poison or toxic elements in our water. I'm also curious that my water board tells me that they've got great water. It sure tastes good in Coos Bay, and they've not told me that there's anything in it. So those are my remarks. If you'd like to respond to any of them, be happy to hear that. But I think that there are some real questions on how to make this effective. Obviously, flushing them down the toilet is not a good idea. Putting them in landfills, if that landfill is sealed, I haven't heard much about that. And then also, Senator Minus Anderson asked how the nursing home and hospitals get rid of their drugs. I'd be interested in that. But also, there's some law enforcement people in the audience today, and you know they have quite large stashes of drugs that they also pick up. So it will be interesting to know. I believe that they incinerate them, but I can't speak for them. So it would be interesting to know exactly what other people are doing. I would disagree that the drugs that our young people are taking are necessarily unused drugs that are in the cabinet. I would suspect that many of them are painkillers that family members are using, and they are deciphering them off. So be happy for any remarks that you have to make on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Berger, I think we're in radical agreement that there are many questions about how best to address this issue, and I understand. Trust me, I understand the kind of economic straits that this state and the other 49 and the District of Columbia and other countries around the globe are facing these days. I share your view that whatever the mechanism is has to be convenient or it simply won't be used. We see that all the time in public health on a wide variety of issues, and there's no reason to think that suddenly in terms of pharmaceutical drugs it's going to be radically different. As you phrase it, the bureaucratic setup or kind of the architecture, if you will, of whatever this mechanism is, I leave to the good policymaking thoughtful consideration of this body and of the legislative branch. Our focus is on how best to implement what the legislature has enacted, and I leave that to your good wisdom. The all agency support, my reason for that, although I had no hand in authoring any of these words, but as a public administrator, my reading of the all agencies must assist is that to make sure that because this issue does touch on so many different direct and indirect aspects for one reason or another, that the advisory committee was not to be hamstrung in trying to deal with the issue because somebody wouldn't bring their ball onto the playground, so to speak, and participate. And so it's just simply a matter of making sure that everybody is engaged in this, because it's not a DHS problem, although DHS isn't very much front and center in the bill. It's an Oregon problem. And so how are we going to deal with this within the executive branch and making sure we all do that? Again, the comment about hospitals and long-term care facilities, hospice, et cetera, I think is a very important one, and I think you'll be hearing about that. The issue around where the drugs or where the pharmaceuticals that we detect in the water, where they come from. Surely they come from a variety of pathways, environmental pathways. I would be shocked if by far and away the largest single pathway was not just human excretion in the treatment plants. From a public health standpoint, as I think you're very familiar, there are many things that we do in terms of prevention and population-based health promotion efforts that we cannot say this action equals this effect. I cannot sit before you today, for example, and say that a thermometer in a chili pot is going to reduce the outbreak of foodborne illness at a particular food service facility. However, what we can identify are risk factors and focus on activities that reduce known risks. And temperatures in terms of food preparation is certainly one of those very known risks. In the same way, I think this kind of model of identifying and then taking actions to reduce overall risk, I put in that same paradigm, and I offer that to you again from a public health model of both the precautionary principle as well as known risk reduction.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, I'll try to speak to the landfill issue. This is not a subject that's got a whole lot of extensive study on it, but I think there's a couple of things to bear in mind as you debate this bill. One is you're right to raise the issue, is the landfill lined or not? The evidence that we have seen suggests that lined landfills are more protective for the pharmaceuticals leaching into the environment. However, I should point out that most of our lined landfills have a leachate collection system that does run through a wastewater treatment facility, and wastewater treatment facilities really don't have an effective technology for removing pharmaceuticals from their leachate, and thus they end up discharging some amounts into the environment. It's a smaller problem, but it does exist. On the other hand, there are unlined landfills actively used in Oregon, and unlined landfills represent more of a problem for pharmaceuticals leaching into the environment. There are 14 landfills, active landfills in Oregon, that have unlined cells. Most of those are located east of the Cascades in 8 of our smaller counties, but they do use unlined landfills, and these are landfills that are in active use. So it is possible that there's a greater risk there of pharmaceuticals leaching through that particular landfill into the environment and surface water or groundwater.
Mr. Chair, yes. I have a question, if I might respond. Unlined landfills are legal?
Yes, Senator and Mr. Chair. They are, because these were landfills that were grandfathered in before we went to the Subtitle D regulations. So there are, and they are in active production for most of them for a substantial period of time.
excuse me. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to make just a couple...
Give us your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Katrina Hedberg. I'm the state epidemiologist with the Public Health Division. I'm sorry. My colleague had introduced me already. So I wanted to make a couple of comments. One is that I agree that I don't think that this bill is the answer to all problems that we have of drug abuse in Oregon. But... ready availability is a little bit different than if somebody, for example, a teen or someone else goes out seeking drugs, is a little bit different than if those drugs are readily available in the medicine cabinet. And I think if any of us went home, myself included, and looked at what was in our medicine cabinet, there are drugs that have been prescribed for past illnesses, injuries, or whatever that are unused and stay there, including narcotics, antibiotics, and other things that then when people take these, the fact that they're available means that, if you will, it may be more tempting for people to take them in the future in ways that have not been originally prescribed. So again, I think that's one little piece of it. If you look at that fact sheet that our office produced, you can really see that the unintentional poisonings, both deaths and hospitalizations, are increasing in our state. Again, I'm not sure that this is the only answer to that question, but this is one piece of the puzzle that I think would be of assistance. I wanted to just address one other thing that you, Mr. Chair, had talked about before around doctor shopping. There actually is some other legislation that's being introduced this session around a prescription drug registry so that people would, if you will, when they went from one doctor to another in search of narcotics, that would be part of the registry. I don't know whether that bill is going anywhere, but that is a separate bill that's been introduced.
Thank you. Did you have testimony now that... Okay.
No.
Good. Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, we're going to hear from Doug Finnan. Okay, Doug, would you come up, please? Tom Holt, would you come up? And Ashlyn Anderson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm here today on behalf of Pharma and on behalf of ASI, which is a biotech company. And with me is Doug Finan, who is an environmental scientist with GlaxoSmithKline. And just at the outset, what I like to say is that you know, we agree that there is a problem here to address. And we commend Senator Dinkfelder for bringing it forth. However, we certainly disagree on the solution that's been offered. What I'd like to do is have Doug address some of the scientific points where he's the real expert here, and then I will deal with some of the other issues.
All right. Just by a little bit of introduction, I've been with GlaxoSmithKline for 19 years. Doing environmental work in a variety of areas. And before that, I was with the State of North Carolina Regulatory Agency for 12 years, doing writing and enforcing and environmental laws and regulations. So hopefully that will convince you that I'm trying to give the right point of view here. I actually have done a pretty fair job of writing what I hope is very eloquent statement there. So I'm going to let you read that at your leisure, and I'm not going to bore you by reading through the whole thing. What I would like to do is make some points. And one of the biggest points is that nobody's more concerned about product stewardship of pharmaceutical products than the pharmaceutical industry. So when we realize that the improvements in analytical techniques were actually showing that pharmaceuticals were being detected in waters, we put together a group of environmental experts to take a look at that. And we really looked at three areas. We were looking at, well, do these have an impact on human health? What's the potential for effects of aquatic life? And again, because of product stewardship and understanding where these come from, we were wanting to evaluate and understand disposal alternatives. Yeah. So most of my time here, I'm going to talk about the disposal alternatives since that's what the bill's about. But just to talk a little bit about the human health effects and the aquatic life effects so that you can understand the conclusions from PhRMA's work. And what we really found out about human health effects is that there really are none. Part of the issue is an issue of detection. Yes, they're detected, and a lot of the testimony, and you got good data on, they're detected. But just because a compound is detected in the environment doesn't necessarily mean that there's a risk. And as a matter of fact, our entire water quality regulation and permit system is based on identifying safe levels of compounds that are detected in the water. Now, to put this in perspective for the pharmaceuticals, if you look at ibuprofen, which is one of the highest volume products, everybody takes it, so it shows up in all of the reports where it's detected. There was a recent article I read where Erie, Pennsylvania had detected ibuprofen in their drinking water at 2.5 parts per trillion. Okay, so if you look at that level, it would take a person drinking their normal daily intake of water 100,000 years to get a single 200 milligram tablet of ibuprofen. So just because you can detect a compound doesn't necessarily mean that there's a problem. Interestingly enough, the water quality drinking water standard for cyanide is in the parts per billion range, so it's much higher than any of the pharmaceuticals being found. All right, so having said that, a lot of people have looked, not only PhRMA member companies, but the American Water Research Association has just come out and said that the pharmaceuticals in water right now are too low to impact human health. GSK, of course, because we're interested in our own compounds, has recently published a paper where we looked at all of our active pharmaceutical products. We calculated what we thought, based on sales, the concentrations would be in water, some of which you couldn't measure, and compared those with safe levels, which we calculated using EPA's criteria for doing that. And we found out that all of those are well below the safe levels, hundreds of times below for some, 10 million times below for others. So the PhRMA's conclusion is that, and other people's as well. The other thing is, your testimony's there. The attachments are all available to you. I gave them on a flash drive so that I wouldn't have to, you know, bring everybody that much paper. Saved a few trees that way. So all of those studies are there. So moving on to the aquatic life effects. Again, for the vast majority of pharmaceutical compounds, there is really no potential to impact aquatic life. Now, I've heard some testimony earlier where it talked about endocrine disruptors, and again, I said for the vast majority. Synthetic hormones are pharmaceutical products. Those are one of the few that have extraordinary circumstances. Synthetic hormones are, well, we've done a study, and the study's there, that basically shows that the levels of synthetic hormones by themselves aren't causing aquatic life effects. But the extraordinary circumstances is there's many other sources of endocrine disruptors, including agricultural runoff, including naturally occurring hormones from humans and other mammals, phytoestrogens. All of those things, in combination, have showed these effects. So, but it's important to know that FDA requires that we do environmental assessments for our compounds prior to their approval, and we have to assess the impact of manufacturing, use, and disposal on the environment.
Let me just interrupt here. We have several other bills to hear. We Excellent. Have lots of people to testify, and you have 5 pages of single-spaced testimony.
Right. I'm not going through it all. Trust me.
Okay.
Get the highlights.
just a
Okay, aquatic life effects. The papers you've got show that for the vast majority, there are no aquatic life effects. But going to the unused disposal question, and it's a question you've had, regardless of whether you feel that there's concern or not, unused medicine isn't really causing it. Not greater than 90%, it was a question you had, greater than 90% of pharmaceuticals in water is from patient excretion, from use excretion, greater than 90%. Now, there's, if everyone flushed their unused medicines, then you'd get about 10% from unused medicines. And, of course, we were concerned about that. We'd been telling people to flush. So because of product stewardship, we said, well, we can't tell people to flush anymore. What should we do? And we began looking at the landfill issues and household trash disposal and what needed to be done. So when we looked at landfills, we found that we did some investigations of landfills which are there. We can get that concentration down to less than 1%. So we can effectively, by putting your medicines in your household trash, you effectively remove it from pharmaceuticals and water. Now, I've heard people said that there were leachate issues. There's two studies that I've included, one done by USGS, one done by EPA, that have basically concluded that pharmaceuticals are not in landfill leachate. In one of the studies, USGS looked for 30 at the parts per trillion level and only found one. The EPA study hasn't been published yet, but an inside EPA article indicated that the landfills were doing a pretty good job of holding them in. So landfill leachate is not an issue. Subtitle D landfills are very good at it. I've talked to the EPA solid waste people, and they have told me that all active landfill cells in the United States are lined landfills with leachate collection, that there are a few grandfathered, unlined landfills in the United States, but those landfills, the active cells, must be lined and have leachate collection. That's what the EPA solid waste people have told me. So based on that, we knew landfills were safe. We entered into the SmartRx program with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and APHA and are getting the word out not to flush your unused medicines. And then we said, well, what about take-back? Which is the actual best way to go? And we found out that, in fact, there really was no difference between a take-back program at the ability to reduce pharmaceuticals in water. Both household trash disposal and take-back for incineration were exactly the same in terms of being able to reduce that number to less than 1%. The reason that take-backs don't reduce at all is because normally less than 10% of people in the United States actually participate in the pilot studies that have been done. Participation rates in take-back programs are very small. So, you know, the question of will people put their medicines in coffee grounds and bags and things like that, that's true, but will they take them back is another question. So, got that. Drug abuse and poisoning, Tom is going to cover, so I won't cover that. I will just summarize by saying, well, I do have one thing on the product stewardship approach. Source reduction was mentioned as the way that they're getting at toxics, and a product stewardship approach really says the first thing is don't generate the waste in the first place. The next is to reuse, recycle, and then finally dispose. And that's what the electronics bill was after that you guys were talking about. For pharmaceuticals, for safety reasons, coming back from the general public, you cannot reuse or recycle those pharmaceuticals. They must be disposed of. So the only reason you're taking them back is to dispose of them, which is really not product stewardship. And we have two disposal methods, household trash and take back for incineration, that both work. So we want to compare, well, other than pharmaceuticals and water, what else? And it turns out we looked at the carbon footprint of both disposal methods, and it turns out in terms of carbon footprint, take-back for incineration has a much higher carbon footprint than does household trash disposal or a mail-back program. But the most effective way is to not generate the waste in the first place. So we're working with EPA now and some other folks to identify ways why medicines go unused, looking at the root causes for why medicines go unused, and begin to investigate that. If we can identify why medicines go unused and educate the healthcare community to reduce the amount of medicines that go unused, then you're actually looking at product stewardship. So we feel that a more effective approach is for this whole issue is to, number one, educate people not to flush, which we're doing with a SmartRx program. Number two, educate people on how to safeguard their medicines in their home, all medicines, not just unused medicines, and to dispose of them immediately. Three, we want to continue research why medicines go unused, and then once we get those root causes, educate the public as to how they can reduce the amount of medicine that goes unused. A far better approach, far more efficient than a take-back program. Thanks.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
There's one other thing I wish that pharma would do, though, because we do have pharmacies that have expired meds coming up a lot in their pharmacies, as well as nursing homes, to develop a technique, if there is one, to be able to have a good disposal system.
I'm working through that. Actually, the partnership that I talked about is not only looking at why medicines go unused, but we're actually, part of that partnership is going to be a long-term care facility company. And we're actually, at the same time, looking at, in long-term care facilities, nursing homes, whatever, what causes them to go unused, and also looking at their disposal options. So that is unique and different than the general public, and we are looking at that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Tom Holt. I want to touch on just on a couple of key issues here. One, the diversion and abuse issue, and secondly, the practical problems that we see with the proposal. One, in regard to diversion and abuse, and Mr. Chair, you and I have worked on these issues for a number of years, and I think you understand very well what some of the real issues are there with people diverting drugs both from the distribution system and from medicine cabinets. The question I would ask, you heard a lot about unintentional drug poisoning. As I look at the fact sheet that was passed out to the committee, there's something really interesting missing, and that's any data about diversion and abuse of expired medications. And I think it's important to focus on the fact that the bill is really attempting to address expired and unused medications, not current medications that people may have a therapy for a current problem. And the fact is, there just is, and it's not a knock on the health division that they don't have the data. It doesn't exist. I've gone looking for it myself. There simply isn't a breakdown of data on poisonings that are either from expired or unexpired, and there's a very logical reason for that. I think intuition would suggest that if the poison center is dealing with someone who has a poisoning going on right now, they're a lot more interested in what the dose was and what it was that someone took than what the expiration date was on the label, and they're dealing with that case. And the industry has for many years supported programs like DARE and others that work in this arena, and has been very supportive of all efforts to work on the diversion issue. There are a number of practical problems with the solution that's been suggested here. Number one, controlled substances. And I provided to the committee a copy of a letter from the Drug Enforcement Administration that deals with the issue of Schedule II drugs. In thumbnail, Schedule II controlled substances, which are your opiates, pain medications, things of that nature, there's a one-way distribution system with checks and balances throughout the system to ensure or protect against diversion, which is a serious problem. So when the product leaves the manufacturer, goes to the wholesaler, from the wholesaler to the pharmacy, each link in the distribution chain has to maintain a perpetual inventory. So if DEA or, in our case, the local board of pharmacy in the state shows up and wants to know, okay, what have you got on hand? They can check against invoices, what's sold, and those numbers had better match up. And the DEA does not want product coming back into the distribution chain in any way that would not have that same check and balance. If you or I bring a controlled substance back in, there's no check against that. And there actually have been cases where people have been prosecuted for diverting drugs from voluntary take-back programs because it is quite tempting when there is not a check and balance to engage in that sort of activity. Secondly, in terms of practical implementation of this, it's important to note that there are hundreds of licensed manufacturers in the state of Oregon. This is not a matter of getting two or three people in a room to figure out how you do a program. There, once you get past the half dozen to a dozen large pharma companies, there are many, many small specialty companies, and there are many generic manufacturers. Generics actually account for about two-thirds of the volume of drugs that are dispensed in the state, and a number of those companies are not even based in the United States. So there's an interesting problem of how you get those folks in a room to actually figure out what's contemplated here, some kind of central program. We believe there would be significant cost. We don't think that the British Columbia model is really a good comparison. It is just an entirely different distribution and regulatory regime in Canada than here, and there's simply no comparison in how they work. There would be cost impacts throughout the distribution chain in that we would have additional tracking to do on any kind of a take-back program. There certainly would appear to be some kind of an impact on retail pharmacies who one way or another are either going to be involved in putting out information on the contemplated program or may even be part of the contemplated program were it enacted.
Tom. Are you saying that the drugs would have to be itemized, the individual amounts? And
Chair Morris said if it was a controlled substance, my understanding is that does have to be very carefully tracked, even when it's coming back.
So if you
it
had
would have to be sorted out, certainly.
Okay, so Senator Mona Sanderson has her big bag of drugs that have been sitting around for a while, various kinds, not necessarily in their package. What would happen?
Well, Chair Moore said if that came back to a pharmacy, somebody's going to have to sort out those products.
Well, sure, okay, let's say it's not going to go to a pharmacy. Let's say there's a different system. I guess my bottom line question is, would each pill have to be accounted for on a take-back program of some kind? When you take bottles and cans back, they're already labeled and marked and standardized, but if you take little white pills and you don't know what they are...
Chair Morris said to the extent that the bill, I believe, requires setting some expectations of success or non-success, there would have to be some kind of accounting, and I'm not quite sure how we would do that. Last, I'll just close that the proponents made a couple of points that I would wholeheartedly agree with. We need to deal with unused medicines in a way that is a safe and convenient system at no cost to the state. I believe it was Gail Shibley said that she'll be shocked if the largest single pathway into the environment of prescription medicines was not excretion. Well, I think you heard from Doug that the largest pathway is, in fact, excretion, and that's in published studies in peer-reviewed journals, not in pharma press releases, but out in the scientific community where people can poke holes in if they want. The safe and most convenient system that I'm aware of is the one that was at my curbside as I pulled out of the driveway this morning. That's the very extensive household collection system we have that we've spent, I think, 30 or 40 years in this country establishing of curbside collection so we can send things to a landfill that's very well regulated. So our suggestion would be that we be allowed to continue to work to educate consumers on proper disposal. We do have some re-education to do because for many years we told people to flush, and we know that's not correct anymore. And the industry is putting some serious resources behind that. As Doug mentioned, we're partnering with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the American Pharmacists Association, and locally with the Oregon Sheriff's Association, amongst others. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, not a question, it's slightly off subject, but I think Senator Mona Sanderson brought up what could potentially be a huge issue if the passing of a relative at an assisted living facility or nursing home is handing all of the prescription drugs to
not
somebody
the assisted
in the
living.
Family.
Huh? Not the assisted living, just the foster care home.
Foster care home. That's a real problem because you're handing a bunch of stuff to somebody who shouldn't have them. So that's another issue outside of this, but something we probably need to look into is should there be some command and control in the facility of dealing with what's left.
And another issue regarding that, Mr. Chair, is, you know, a number of us have been interested in toxic waste being dumped into our rivers from the industry. I would really like to know how the manufacturers of prescription drugs take care of their waste. Because I know we have a huge problem with farms, and all of that goes into the river, and we try to set up standards, and, you know, you need to get rid of your waste. So it'd be interesting to have the manufacturers of the prescription drugs come back and say how they get rid of their waste. And I'm sure there's a lot of waste when you're making pharmaceuticals.
Well, I see a representative of the pharmaceutical industry sitting back in the corner there, and I will ask him to gather information, Mr. Gardner, and come back and enlighten us about how the industry disposes of waste in their factories, which is a good question.
And I'll send you something on that. We just did something on that for GSK, so I will send it to you.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, following up on Senator Cruz's comments, are the pills that you have, are they loose? Are they in packages? Are they
they're in the bottles.
They're in the bottles. Okay,
yeah.
So they're identifiable. Okay, good.
Okay.
Yes. We're going to have to move along here.
Okay. I'll try not to repeat myself.
I know.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yeah. My name is Ashlyn Anderson, and I am here on behalf of the Consumer Healthcare Products Association. CHPA represents the leading manufacturers of over-the-counter medicines and nutritional supplements in the United States. And I'll just say I'm happy to be back in this building where I got my start in public policy. So CHPA opposes this measure for two reasons. First, we believe that drug take-back programs are ineffective at addressing these three problems. And you've heard a number of reasons for that raised by my colleagues here. In addition, we believe that broad public awareness of the proper use, storage, and disposal of over-the-counter medicines is the best way to address these concerns. To the first point, take-back is ineffective, as we've heard, because more than 90% of pharmaceutical waste in the water comes from human excretion or human use of the actual products. Unlike items in the consumer electronics waste programs that can be recycled upon return to the manufacturer, drugs cannot be recycled. They must be incinerated or destroyed somehow. In addition, medicines are meant to be used to completion. If I have additional over-the-counter medicines in my medicine cabinet, it's because I want to be able to take an ibuprofen when I have a headache or use my toothpaste in the morning. And to that point, CHPA represents 70 companies that produce things like pain relievers and antihistamines, all the way to toothpaste, medicated lip balm, sunscreen, antiperspirants. The way that drug is defined in this bill, all of those consumer products like toothpaste and medicated lip balm would be considered drugs, and the manufacturers of those products would have to pay into the system, even though Oregonians with, you know, unused Blitzdex are not going to bring it back to the program. So those are the reasons it's ineffective. On the broad consumer awareness point, you've heard from others, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, EPA, White House Office on National Drug Control Policy, the American Pharmacists Association, and the FDA have all issued similar guidelines that discourage flushing and encourage disposal through the household trash as a safe alternative for disposal of unused medicines. CHPA has joined with Pharma and others in support of the Safe Drug Disposal Northwest program. That's like a version of the SmartRx program that has begun already in Washington State to issue brochures and posters in pharmacies educating consumers on how to do this proper drug disposal, and I believe it's going to be spread here into Oregon shortly. This type of program has the added benefit of complying with DEA controlled substances regulations, discouraging theft from collection bins or mailboxes, and being as convenient as curbside recycling. As we know, any good public policy is something that people actually use. So we believe that consumer awareness programs are better public policy. Finally, CHPA, in order to address things like intentional abuse of over-the-counter medicines, particularly cough syrup, and unintentional misuse, poisonings of small children, has partnered with a number of groups you've heard of, like the Community Anti-Drug Coalitions of America, the Partnership for Drug-Free America, Dare America. We've also created our own websites and public awareness campaigns about OTCsafety.org. We have a group called Five Moms that gets mothers together to talk on the web and have a community to share about teen drug abuse of over-the-counter and prescription medicine. So we've done a lot to address these issues on that level. And after looking into these issues, we believe that that sort of public education is much more effective because kids really aren't just taking it out of the household trash. It's more about teaching them how to safely use these products. So because CHPA shares the public policy concerns raised by the proponents of this measure, and because we've researched the methods of addressing them and concluded that public awareness campaigns are the best vehicle for addressing these concerns, CHPA respectfully opposes Senate Bill 598. And I'd also be, happy to take any questions.
Okay. Where in the bill does it specify the scope of the take-back?
You mean where it includes over-the-counter drugs?
Yeah.
It says the definition of drug refers to, I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, refers to the way that drug is defined in statute, which is modeled after the FDA's definition of drug, which includes basically anything that has a drug facts label on it, and that's where you get medicated toothpaste. Toothpaste with fluoride, for example, has a drug facts label. Antiperspirants, things of that nature, are considered drugs by the FDA.
Okay, we're going to check out the statute, but it would be interesting to have that clearly defined in terms of scope.
Yes.
And on the products that are included, and for the benefit of those who are the proponents of the bill, that would be very important because... Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are a number of people who've driven over 100 miles and traveled over 100 miles, and of course Doug is one of them, but he came the easy way by plane. Okay, the Scott Gage, chief from Winston, and Blake Rice, pharmacist. Blake here, okay. And Kathleen Finn from the Confederated Tribes of at Umatilla, would you please come up? And, okay. Scott, would you like, Chief, would you like to go ahead?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Senator Morissette, and members of the committee. Thanks for allowing me to speak to you today about a program that Winston, the city of Winston,
himself?
Started.
I'm sorry.
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. Introduce yourself again. Winston, I believe.
Scott Google, Winston Police Google. Department.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Folks, I'm here to address a program that the city of Winston started really a number of months ago, probably around last year. And it was to address the problem, and the problem was access. Myself, as well as many of our officers, have actually taken cases where junior high students have access, things like oxycodone and from their parents' cabinets. Don't know whether it was expired or unused at the time, but it was accessed. And took it to school and experimented with their friends with those medications. I don't think that Winston's problem is any different than any other community in the state of Oregon or the nation, quite frankly. It is a very common drug of experimentation with teens now. It is actually the number two drug that they're accessing, the predominant or the only one more than that is marijuana. The way this started basically is, we needed a program in place, and what it was to limit the access. So we actually did some homework, and we thought that the police department could be a drop-off point for people that had unused medications. And we actually did talk to the DA about the process of turning unused medications to us. This was a community caretaking function, so we weren't really wanting to count every pill. We wanted to make this something that we could document, but to document every single pill that came in would be a huge time restraint on my officers. It's been a great success. I can tell you that in 6 months' time, we've actually been to the incinerator once already. Just pills alone. Pills have been emptied out of containers, 45, 50 pounds of just pills, as well as a huge amount of liquid medications like liquid morphine, fentanyl patches, things of that nature. It's been a certain amount of cost to the city of Winston. I mean, we spend hours doing some of this, but if we can limit the access of just one or two cases that we previously have taken, I think it's been a great success. Again, it's been very good for us, and I think the success of any program, and it's been a big success for the city of Winston, we've gotten lots of press on it, has been getting the word out. And I think if the community knows that there is this access point where they can drop off the meds, they'll use it. It comes in bags, such as you said, where people have a deceased loved one that has died, and they have this huge package of medications that they are now burdened with and don't know what to do, to people that are just never knew what to do with the medications and are now turning them in. But we have a huge amount of success with our program. I think a program, whether it lives or dies, has to do with what the populace knows about it. And again, it's easy access. We don't ask a lot of questions. We do take cases, and we do document all the medications that come in. We just don't document, each individual pill. So
just a question.
That's really interesting. Yes.
So where do they bring the medication?
To the police department.
To the police department. Wow.
Stop by.
Okay. And I'll bring my bag.
And where do you take them to incinerate them?
Currently, the last place we took them to is the Coos Bay site, Bunny Hill, has an incinerator with all the appropriate filters on it to burn those medications, and they've been great to work with.
Okay. Now, you do keep track somewhat.
Yes, we've over that six-month period of time, we've taken in over 100 cases.
Yeah.
Where we've documented medications coming into my department. And, again, my populace is 5,800 people.
Yeah.
So, again, I think we've had kind of great success with this.
Well, that raises an interesting question, because we go from one extreme to the other. I mean, my extreme was you would have to sit and document pills and so on, but in your plan, you...
I'm documenting the chemicals that are coming in, or as best I can, because...
Okay.
I do have people that bring in bags of medication because they don't want to see...
Okay, if there's a half-filled bottle of a particular medication, a painkiller, oxycodone, do you write five pills oxycodone?
No, we write in taking one bottle of oxycodone.
Oh, okay.
And the pills get dumped into a bin with
I don't know that there's any. I guess if we really wanted to make it complicated, we would require any take back program to, you know, meticulously document, but there's nothing wrong with, I mean, I think what you're doing is very innovative and
gets
the job
done. We're
trying
to provide public service. Yeah. Quite honestly, if, you know, a person comes in, they drop off the bag and they leave, and then you do the count. If you were going to write their name and all this information on there, I think it would be a deterrent to people
and
being
we don't
able
do that.
To do it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I know. What I'm saying, they don't do that. The person just drops it off and they're gone. So it's non-invasive from the.
Again, out of curiosity, what volume have you taken in, just in general terms, from that somewhat limited population? And if you extrapolated that to Portland, I mean, what you.
I probably have a huge, huge volume. But again, I'm getting, you know, 40-pound bins of just pills over that six-month time, as well as another container the same size full of liquid medications, like liquid morphine and fentanyl patches, things like that. So I've considered it a huge success.
But you don't mess with toothpaste and suntan lotion, right?
I have not gotten any toothpaste. As of yet.
That's interesting.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I think that shows that there is a problem out there. I mean, there's a huge amount of medication that should be properly disposed of in some form or fashion.
Well, taking it to law enforcement, you may be setting a trend here, you know. I mean, taking it to the law enforcement people is a safe place to take it.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's an advantage we find in smaller communities that do have a sense of community and levels of trust and cooperation that you may not find quite as prevalent in a more urban area. So, I mean, Winston as a community works together on virtually anything that happens in that community.
Sure.
So there is a tremendous sense of community in that town.
Just keep them away from the tigers and the lions and the elephants, okay?
Well, in this case, bears, I think, was the last bear. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Kathleen Fien, and I'm the Senior Policy Analyst for the Department of Natural Resources for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. The tribes are here today to request your support of Senate Bill 598, the Oregon Drug Take-Back Program. From the tribe's perspective, this is a sound solution to what the tribes see as a long-standing problem. We as Oregonians, in many ways, are coming to terms with the reality that there are real and important consequences to treating our rivers and our water systems as garbage disposals. And one of those many consequences is that unwanted drugs that are frequently flushed into our waters can remain there. Some of these drugs are designed to be quite long-lasting because that has therapeutic benefits in the human body. And some of them, however, continue to be fairly stable in the environment. And they end up in our fish and the people who eat fish and the people who use those waters. Assessments of health risks are typically based upon standard exposure assumptions, and those exposure assumptions are usually for healthy adults. Those assumptions may or may not be protective of all members of our communities. Umatilla tribal members still participate in their traditionally fish-rich diet, and our most traditional people eat 52 fish meals per month, so a great deal more than a fish meal a day. And they eat the vast majority of their fish from local wild-caught fish that are collected from Oregon streams and rivers. And as long as we as a state continue to rather standardly dump the chemicals that we use into our rivers, the tribe's traditional diet also exposes those members to substantial risks from toxic chemicals in their fish, including pharmaceuticals. And the tribe is concerned about the long-term cumulative health effects of pollution associated with these chemicals, especially on those members of our communities which are most vulnerable. Families which rely upon wild-caught fish to feed their families, our children and babies, women of childbearing age, and people in ill health who may be more sensitive to these types of chemicals when they do encounter them. And the tribe is also particularly concerned about the increasingly common identification of pharmaceutical chemicals in fish. Our recent discussion with regional fish experts about this topic concluded that not much is really known about the long-term effects of pharmaceutical chemicals on fish, but that we are frequently finding drugs in fish where the studies are being done. These are the same fish upon which the tribe's culture depends. These are also the same fish that we as a region are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to save. And we do not fully understand the consequences of finding these drugs in our fish. But we do know that our endangered fish do not need to be on Prozac or birth control or any other medication that is designed for humans. The tribe's healthcare clinic and many pharmacies already provide for safe, secure collection and disposal of medical sharps. Usually these are needles associated with injecting medications. On the reservation and throughout our communities, this prevents the misuse of these necessary but potentially dangerous items by returning them, in that case, to a pharmacy setting where all of the appropriate security measures are already in place to secure the drugs that the facility dispenses. We believe that an unwanted drug take-back program can be designed by working with the pharmaceutical manufacturers to provide these same protections and convenience to our communities. In September of last year, 54 Northwest tribal governments met on the Umatilla Indian Reservation in the annual conference of the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians. And at that meeting, the tribes recognized that unwanted drugs affect the waters of all of our tribes and that those drugs also are affecting our fisheries throughout our region. And at the September meeting, the United Tribes passed a resolution supporting legislation and other efforts to establish secure, convenient medicine return programs to reduce harmful public health and environmental impacts from unwanted medicines. And we've provided that resolution for your review and consideration. So we appreciate the opportunity to offer our support for Senate Bill 598 and to share with you the tribe's perspective, what they think is a good solution to an ongoing problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Blake?
Blake Rice, pharmacist from Riddle, Oregon. I'm here to represent OSPA. Some of the concerns that retail pharmacies have about the bill itself. First of all, you know, America is becoming a heavily medicated society, and there are lots of unused medications out there. There isn't a pharmacy in the state that isn't confronted every day with someone that brings in a bag of medication, and what do I do with these? Pharmacies are forbidden to take those back currently. The best thing that pharmacies are doing now is educating people not to flush, you know, mix them with kitty litter or coffee grounds, put them in a sealed bag and dispose of them, you know, in the regular landfill. I will say that I have sent several patients to Winston that had bags to drop off their stuff. Some were a little reluctant to do that. I mean, just having a bag of medication and walking to a police station just doesn't. Why would you send me to the police station? Well, they have a collection system now, and they do take care of them properly. So, you know, you can see that there's a little bit of a, there will be some pushback if that's the adopted way. Not that what they're doing isn't great stuff. But that's the pushback that pharmacists see on a daily basis. By having a take-back system at the pharmacy, the pharmacy is going to incur some cost. You have to have a site to store it. You have some way to manage when that box is full. You seal it up. Somebody's got to pay to have that sent off. You're going to pay one of your employees to box that up and send it off. So there's going to be some cost there. And I think that's where pharmacists have their biggest fear, is that they're going to be saddled with that cost. And with reimbursements being reduced, in fact, DHS just sent out a letter April 1st, everybody's going to be reduced again, so it's going to make it problematic to cover that cost. I think pharma does have a responsibility to help educate patients on proper disposal. I think pharmacies have that responsibility as well. I think it's becoming more of a common practice now that when you counsel patients on prescriptions that they're instructed on. If you don't use all this medication, you can dispose of it by mixing with coffee grounds or kitty litter and putting it in a bag and get rid of it, get it out of your house. So the education piece, I think, is probably the biggest key. But then I just want to iterate the concerns that the pharmacy community has about the cost that would be incurred if it's through the pharmacy itself. I mean, pharmacies are pretty well squeezed right now. There's, you know, they're consolidating everywhere. Independents are going out of business. Some chains are going out of business because they're selling to other chains because they're trying to come up with some economical way to stay in business. Adding costs that are unreimbursable makes it pretty tough. So that's probably the main concern that I have as a pharmacist. I think OSPA members have as a problem. Not that the problem doesn't exist. Right now, most pharmacies contract with someone. When we have outdated drugs, we reverse wholesale it. We send it back to someone who does incinerate it or dispose of it properly. Hospitals do that. Long-term care facilities do that. There is a process for properly disposing of those medications right now. It's just educating the public that has the vast majority of it out there that when they have extra medications, there are proper ways to get rid of it. And if you can convince people to do that, you save everybody the hassle. And that's basically what I would say. If you have some questions,
any questions?
Just real quick.
So pharmacists, are they required by law to take their expired medications, box them up and incinerate them, or you said send them back? Or
well, it's called reverse wholesaling. There's companies out there that's what they do. They'll take care of all that outdated medication for you. So you just box it up and send it to them. Some of it actually can be reimbursed because the pharmaceutical manufacturers realize you're not going to dispense everything you bought from them, and you get a reimbursement for some of that you send back. Anything that's outdated and can't be reimbursed is just disposed of by that company.
And it'd be interesting to know how those companies dispose of them. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they're fairly well regulated by EPA, and that most of them incinerate. That's what they say, they incinerate the medication. So.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I'm not giving this back.
Cool. Coup d'etat. You leave the room and then
Mr. Chair, if I could read into the record, because the question was about prescription or non-prescription drugs, and what it says in the ORS is, it's in section 689.005. You got to go down half the page, but it said articles intended for use in diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease in a human or other animal. And then articles other than food intended to affect the structure or any function of the body of humans or other animals, and articles intended for the use as a component of any articles specified in paragraphs above. So it's fairly broad what we consider to be a drug in the ORS. You can have your gavel back now.
Oh, thank you. That's interesting. Okay, anybody else over 100 miles? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing, and I'm sorry for those of you who came. We did not intend to spend the entire time on this bill. We have four other bills that we have to deal with, and so I will close the public hearing. Thank you very, very much, and we're going to open a public hearing. We're going to open a work session for information on Senate Bill 355. And Rob Govette, would you please come up? I don't believe we are going to get to the other bills. Senate Bill 550, 551, 552 are on the agenda. Each of these bills has some work to be done. There are amendments to them, and we can come back to them. We'll carry them over until Monday. Senate Bill 550, 551, 552 will be carried over, and I think we can deal with all of them at one time, actually. The nature of those particular bills can be dealt with. quickly. Their single page DHS will be here, and the proponent of that bill will be those. So Monday for those bills. Now today we're going to hear, we're going to talk about the dash twos on 355. Now the problem with the dash twos is that they deal with a lot of a variety of information, and it's hard to look at the bill and look at the dash twos and understand what's going on. Now, our trustee, would you like to say a word about what you did with the dash twos before I turn it over to Rob?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you'll have in your packet a copy of the original bill, Senate Bill 355, and in the right it has hand and gross dash two amendments. And what I attempted to do is to mark out and revise into the original bill all of the changes that were made through the dash two so that you would have one document to look at. The writing in some of the areas is rather small, so I apologize for that. But that incorporates the dash twos with the original bill.
Okay, so we do have in our packet your copy of,
right.
Yes, okay. Now, I suggest that we look at the engrossed version, hand engrossed version of Senate Bill 355 with the dash twos.
Mr. Chair, if we could also have Rob speak to the dash threes, which was the last memo, which we also have. So,
he also has a hand engrossed, right?
He was on the commission list.
Yes, but it's really ugly. It's almost best that you look at the, in my opinion, best that you look at the dash twos, and we try to explain what the pieces are in them, and so you'll understand how they fit. It will be nice to see this as an A engrossed version, because it's just almost impossible to hand interlineate all the engrossments as the administrator attempted to do, and I attempted to do as well.
Okay.
What the dash twos really result from is a work group trying to work through all of the various suggestions and issues that were raised. There's a lot of language in the dash twos amendments, of course, but really a lot of it is technical changes from legislative council to implement the substance. So just going through the dash twos in order, the first large change you will see is the confining of Senate Bill 355 to Schedules 2 through 4 of the controlled substance schedules. So it wouldn't deal with all prescription drugs. Legend drugs would be left off. The second large change further down on page 1 of the dash 2s is plugging affirmatively into the bill, although I would argue it was implicit before, but let's get rid of implications. Let's just be explicit, specifically including a requirement for compliance with HIPAA, the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, as well as federal A&D regulations, which is 42 CFR Part 2, as well as state confidentiality laws, both implemented HIPAA and 42 CFR and our state confidentiality health laws as well. So those were the substantive changes on page 1 of the dash 2 amendments. On page 2 of the dash amendments, there are additional changes made by the legislative council to conform things to what I just spoke about. In addition, again, avoiding any implications and being explicit, inserting the probable cause standard for getting a court order for law enforcement to get access to any of this information, requiring that health boards certify in writing their need to have access to any of this for specific investigatory purposes. Also adding toward the bottom of page 2 a specific, I think it was somewhat by implication, but we're avoiding implications, adding a new section 6 to basically say that a pharmacist may not refuse to fill a valid prescription solely because they can't get the information from the PMP at the time to ensure that patients get access to the medications they've been prescribed. And then specifically adding in a new section 7 to spell out specific civil penalties for intentional violations or breaches of access. that carries over onto page 3. The large change on the bottom of page 3 is adding and subtracting a variety of additional members to the PMP board. As we discussed at the hearing last time, this would make all of those changes. It now grows to 15 members, which actually is an odd number, so that's probably the right answer, as well as, and it includes adding a member of the public and the DHS language that the Department of Human Services requested, specifically spelling those things out. So fundamentally, that's what you have in your Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 3 amendments, which we didn't get worked through in time to put into the Dash 2 amendments, it's probably a good thing because then they just get even longer. The fundamental purpose of the Dash 3 amendments is to ensure that the way I characterize it, this is the anti-fishing expedition amendment specifically requested by one of the senators, that we not just, again, imply that this shouldn't be done, but we actually say that you can't be fishing around for docks that may be over-prescribing. That's not the purpose of this bill, and I agree that's not the purpose of this bill. So that's what the Dash 3 amendments would do. That's my kind of 50,000-foot explanation of what you have in the Dash 2s and Dash 3s.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, your intention is to amend the bill so when we deal with it, we have a clear copy of something to pass out.
Right.
So we are in work sessions. And
okay, wait just a minute. Dash 1s are included in the Dash 2s. So
Dash 1s are within the Dash 1s are the DHS language that are already included in Dash 2s.
Dash 2s, okay. Right.
So you wouldn't need the Dash 1s anymore. They've been superseded.
Now, let me just ask a couple of questions, clarification. You have worked on this, and you were kind of the scribe, and people contacted you. So is this pretty much what everybody suggested? I mean, are we done with this now, do you think?
Well, I guess I leave that for you, Senator. I think we've spent a lot of time on this bill over multiple sessions, and the work group that met to try to work through all of the suggestions, I think we tried to incorporate as many as we thought we could without really impairing the bill such that it would be ineffective or would drive a fiscal. So I think we've reached a point where I'm not sure what more to do to this poor bill.
Okay, so the intent would be then if we can adopt the amendments and have the bill printed with the amendments, we could then understand pretty much what the bill is saying, for sure. I mean, that would be, and we would then take another look at it to see if there's anything else and if people on the committee have some concerns. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rob, just a clarification. On page 2, where it says this section does not apply to pharmacies and institutions as defined in the ORS. Explain that to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I skipped over that. That is actually the piece requested by DHS that basically says that state institutions, and we're talking about the mental health institution, the state hospital, and the prison system,
right,
wouldn't be in the PMP because, frankly, there's no purpose to have them in the PMP.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the technical language that we worked up to get DHS what they wanted to have.
DHS is happy with that, by the way. So,
okay.
I just got a smile from the back.
So far as I know.
Well, would you like to come up? Or you can just smile and nod. That's okay.
She gave me
okay,
a thumbs up.
Thumbs
so I thought
up. Okay,
that
that's
okay.
Fine. That's fine. That's good. Okay. Okay. So we're ready
Mr.
for a
Chair,
moment. Yes.
I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 355.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves a Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 255. Discussion. Objections. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 355.
Senator Cruz moves a Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 355. Discussion. Opposition. Seeing none. So ordered.
I wish we were sending this to Ways and Means today.
Well, it would be nice, but we're going to take a look at it and let people see what it is and go from there. Okay?
Just thought I'd give you my...
I know. It would be nice. Okay, with that, then we will close the work session on Senate Bill 355, and unless there is other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Thank you. Okay, we're out of here early, folks.
Maybe we could have done those others.
Could have been here all day, I think.
I forgot to ask people who were here who had written...